11:07.
Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The sudden death of Minnesota Senator Paul Wellstone has shaken people on both sides of America's political scene. Those on the left feel they have lost one of their most passionate and principled voices. And even those on the right have praised his high ideals and feisty campaign style. But the crash of the small plane that took the life of Wellstone, his wife, his daughter, and five others last Friday has had another effect as well. It is one in which Wellstone himself might concede there's a certain tragic irony. That is, quite simply, that these days there has to be some sort of dramatic event to remind voters that there's even an election underway. His death has added another layer of political uncertainty to the Minnesota race at a time when so many other Senate races are up in the air. Connection listeners, what is at stake in the fight for control of the Senate? And at a time of such international conflict, does a divided Congress help or hinder the nation's foreign policy? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined on the line now by Bill Salisbury. Bill is a reporter and columnist with the St. Paul Pioneer Press. He's in the Minnesota Capitol. Hi, Bill.
Good morning.
A couple of practical matters. Tomorrow is the day set aside for the memorial service. Is that right?
That's right.
And is there any sign that there's still an election underway in Minnesota, or is all the forums, debates, ads, that sort of stuff, is it all finished for now?
It has all ceased, temporarily at least. All the ads that we've been bombarded with ads since we have both a U.S. Senate race, two hot congressional races, and a gubernatorial race going on here that's very close. And all of a sudden, all that advertising is gone.
And yet there is talk, as much as a confirmation as we're likely to get, that former Vice President Walter Mondale will stand in for Senator Wellstone. Is that your read as well?
Yes, that's right. The Democratic Party is preparing to nominate a candidate to replace Senator Wellstone on the ballot on Wednesday night. And so far, the only name that really has surfaced is that of Walter Mondale.
And given, Bill, that it was such a contentious, cantankerous campaign leading up to Mr. Wellstone's death last Friday. What happens now? Will a campaign even restart under the circumstances?
Well, it will restart, but it will be very different. It will be relatively quiet. It will be very civil, and it certainly will be brief.
And if it's civil, does that mean that support, a sympathy vote for Mr. Wellstone will aid the Democrats? Is that the current read?
There's some speculation, but I don't think anybody knows for certain how voters are going to react. But I do think that the tone of the campaign will be much, much different. As you said, we had a contentious race here. It was a lively race between two candidates who were clever debaters. They really enjoyed going after each other's records. I think they enjoyed the battle. But now I think because of the grieving that's going on and an out of respect for Senator Wellstone, I think the tone will be much more subdued. And I think the campaigning, what there is of it, will be much more positive.
Bill, thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Glad to do it.
Bill Salisbury is a reporter and columnist with the St. Paul Pioneer Press. Let me bring in my guests for the hour. Kirk Victor is political reporter for the National Journal. That's a highly regarded magazine about politics and government in Washington. Sarah Binder's with us. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and associate professor of political science at George Washington University. Sarah Binder, just a thought from you on what the political change in Minnesota is likely to mean there.
Well, first, I guess, echoing Bill Salisbury, it's a terrible blow for the Democratic Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. I think it takes them all, obviously, by surprise and leaves, as Bill suggested, a bit uneasiness of how to conduct a four-day campaign if we assume it starts sometime on Friday. Obviously, if it is someone like Mondale, he's extensively well-liked in Minnesota. If someone like Coleman to run a campaign Traditionally, one would try to drive up Mondale's negatives, but that's just not going to be in the picture, given the tragic events of last weekend. So the context is uneasy there, and it's something Minnesotans are probably not looking forward to at all.
And Kirk Victor, I mean, in many ways, a story not unlike what happened in Missouri in 2000.
That is exactly right, Dick. The interesting one thought that I had was, would this tragedy have any impact on that Missouri race? That hasn't been talked about a great deal, but Jean Carnahan, the widow of Mel Carnahan, who was running for the Senate against John Ashcroft, is up this year in a very tight race against former Congressman Jim Talent. So I wondered, what I have read, and I've not done any reporting myself on this, I don't think that there has been any impact. But one other point to make, I was interested over the weekend that both the top Democratic leaders in the Senate, Tom Daschle and Harry Reid, chided Norm Coleman for having run such a relentlessly negative campaign, in their view, against Paul Wellstone. And, of course, Mr. Coleman is hardly in a position to respond to those kinds of criticisms at this point.
In your view, does it mean that when we look at what will happen in Minnesota, Kirk, that it's likely to go to Mr. Mondale simply because of his name recognition or whatever sort of sympathy there may be for the Wellstone family?
I am reluctant to make a prediction because I just don't know. I would
Right.
say that the polls in the last few days before the tragedy showed Senator Wellstone edging ahead of Norm Coleman. I think the last poll I saw showed him ahead by 5 points. Obviously, there's going to be enormous goodwill toward former Vice President Mondale for stepping in. And perhaps he will be the favorite, but given the volatility of politics today, I think it's probably not a smart thing to make predictions.
Sarah, if you step back and look at what's happening across the country, you can pick a dozen races, maybe 16 of the Senate races, where things are still, even a week before the vote, too close to call.
Right. And one of the things to keep in mind here is this is clearly a reflection of this tight party division across the country. I mean, most dramatically seen in the 2000 presidential race, but easily reflected in the near 50-50 split we've got in the Senate today and near 50-50 split percentage-wise in the House. So as you say, we can go across the country and find dead heat statistically in any number of races, some with Democratic incumbents, some with Republican incumbents. We can walk through some of those if you'd like. But I think the thing to keep in mind here is it reflects a deep division here at all levels in terms of this partisan split in the narrow middle that determines the outcome in each of these tight races.
Let's do that. Let's get Kirk to start us off. You're just back from South Carolina. Am I right, Kirk?
That is correct.
And tell me what you – I mean, it's not just South Carolina. It's North Carolina and Tennessee. I mean, there's a lot that's up in the air in the South.
No question about it, Dick. There are four open seats in the South in which Republican incumbents are leaving. In South Carolina, the 99-year-old Strom Thurmond, who was first elected in 1954, is retiring. And there is a race between two, I think, engaging candidates in many ways, Republican Congressman Lindsey Graham, who became to national attention as a House impeachment manager during the impeachment of President Clinton. And he's running against a very charming raconteur, former president of the College of Charleston, Alex Sanders. And it is a race in which South Carolina is such a Republican state that one would have to give Graham an edge, but Mr. Sanders has made a race of it. And then the other departures in the South, Jesse Helms in North Carolina, somewhat irascible at times, known as Senator No for his hostility to the United Nations and to other things that did not jibe with his sort of conservative social agenda. His departure has opened up an opportunity for Democrats, and Erskine Bowles, President Clinton's former chief of staff, is facing Elizabeth Dole, who is was a cabinet officer, both labor secretary and transportation secretary. Again, an interesting race.
Can I just interrupt you for half a second?
Sure, sure.
I'm interested
absolutely.
In knowing, as you look at those two races, are the issues discussed, you know, whether or not the government should go to Iraq and Homeland Security, or are they much more local issues?
Well, it's interesting. In the South, I think more than other regions, given the sort of outspoken patriotism and pro-defense attitudes, that you hear far more about support for President Bush and national issues than is usual the case. Now, Social Security has been a hot issue in both of those states, with both of the Republican candidates in those cases saying that a portion of young workers' Social Security funds ought to be invested as those workers would like, whether it be in the stock market or elsewhere. So they are running a little bit on the reform platform. The two Democrats have blistered those proposals as being irresponsible given the performance of the stock market. So Social Security is an issue that's getting a lot of play. President Bush has made repeated trips to all these southern states and all over the country in order to try to rally the base, I think, primarily. And just to mention very briefly the two other retirements, former and perhaps future Hollywood actor Fred Thompson is retiring in Tennessee, and Lamar Alexander, the former governor, Republican and two-time presidential candidate, is running against a congressman named Bob Clement. And in Texas, Phil Graham, a staunch, outspoken, sort of intellectual conservative, is retiring. And Ron Kirk, the Democrat, if elected, would be the first African-American or the only African-American in the Senate. And he's running against the state attorney general, John Cornyn. So with four southern seats up, Democrats thought, and I suppose still do think, that they have a shot at picking up perhaps one of those four seats. And if they do that, their odds of retaining control of the Senate are quite good.
And, Sarah, how important is Bush's participation in races like the ones that Kirk's just walked us through?
Well, as Kirk hinted there, what's critical here in these midterm elections particularly is turning out a base of vote, particularly where these are such tightly contested races. Now, there are pros and cons to President Bush leaving the White House to go in the stump for these candidates. Historically, the president's party tends to lose seats in midterm elections, and one might sort of theoretically think through, well, if in places where he's visited in this campaign, if in fact he loses seats there, the election looks bad and reflects bad poorly on the president's standing. But Bush may have the ability to circumvent that problem simply because his poll ratings are so high. It may work actually to his advantage.
We'll have a chance to talk more about that. The number's 1-800-423-8255. Just a week to the midterm elections, balance of the Senate up in the air. What's at stake here, in your view? 1-800-423-TALK. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-TALK. This hour, a conversation about big changes underway for the Senate, almost in, I suppose, in spite of the tight races that are taking place right around the country. We've talked about the change in Minnesota politics as a result of the tragic death of Senator Paul Wellstone last Friday, and a little bit about the resignations in the South. With me on the program today, Sarah Binder. She's senior fellow at Brookings Institution, associate professor of political science at George Washington University, and Kirk Victor, political reporter with the National Journal. And to both of you, you know, if you take
Jesse Helms and Strom Thurmond and Phil Gramm and Fred Thompson and Paul Wellstone away from the Senate that has become slightly familiar, it's going to be a very different institution.
Well, I think that's right. We lose with this new coming Congress these very strong voices on the far left and very strong voices on the far right who have, in Helms' case, obviously stood for particular ideologies for a good 30-plus years. They've been on the national political spectrum. But I think we'll find in the upcoming Congress that probably the Senate is at least as polarized as it's been over the last few Congresses, mm-hmm. that seems to be, at least for the while, the trend line in the Senate and the House. That is, Republican constituencies have moved somewhat to the right over the past decade or so, and similarly for the Democrat constituencies moving to the left. Obviously, in the Senate, sometimes we get more moderate candidates, say Ben Nelson from Nebraska in the last election, Mary Landrieu in Louisiana, somewhat toward the center, John Breaux. But by and large, it's harder to find these more centrist candidates and senators as the two parties' bases move farther and apart.
Kirk.
Well, I would just add, when you lose Strom Thurmond and a Jesse Helms, even though Strom Thurmond has been in very frail health the last few years and has not been terribly visible in Washington, it is striking, and it is, and also Phil Gramm, who is an ardent conservative, who more an economic conservative than a social conservative, a tenacious debater. You're losing a very large personalities. And in each case, I would argue that they will be replaced, whoever wins, whether it's the Republican or the Democrat, by more moderate candidates, more sort of centrist, even though they're Southerners, and folks who are not quite as flashy as these. So it will be a different institution stylistically, I think, although I agree with Sarah about the polarization.
Okay, I'm a little lost here because I'm hearing Sarah say that the right marches right and the left marches left, but there is, Kirk, you're saying some move towards the center. Does that also occur from the left and from the right?
Well, I just think in looking, and I'm looking really specifically at these four Southern races, look at who might replace Jesse Helms, Elizabeth Dole or Erskine Bowles. Well, neither of them at all is where Jesse Helms is. They both are pretty centrist, mm-hmm. Even though Mrs. Dole has tried to suggest that she would pursue Helms' agenda. The fact of the matter is, I think that she would be far more moderate. Look at South Carolina, Strom Thurmond, although he had softened his views on race in the last decade or more than a decade, I suppose, voted for the Voting Rights Act. You have two figures, Lindsey Graham and Alex Sanders, for whom race is not an issue at all. And in Texas, Ron Kirk. Now, he was a mayor of Dallas. The business community there liked him quite a bit. He, again, is more centrist and has presented himself that way in this campaign than many Democrats might. And he's facing off against John Cornyn, the attorney general, who has given President Bush a big bear hug and used President Bush to advance himself. And in Tennessee, Fred Thompson. You will have either Lamar Alexander, clearly a moderate, or Democrat Bob Clement. So in these four races, and I'm really confining my remarks to those, it's interesting to me that you could argue that all of these potential replacements are more moderate than the folks that who have been there.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's start out in Boston. Linda's on the line. Hi, Linda.
Yes. First, I would like to say a word about Senator Wellstone. In my day, I have written a lot of letters to a lot of senators, and only one ever sent me a reply with a personal signature on it, and that senator was Paul Wellstone.
Now, were you living in Minnesota at the time? Or
of course not. I was living right here in Boston, Massachusetts. This was a man who had a national constituency, and I would turn on the television to C-SPAN and watch the Senate, and when I believe I saw the very last speech he ever gave on the floor, and he was fighting to get an extension to unemployment benefits. And, of course, Don Nichols was there on the floor to veto his unanimous consent request. But nevertheless, he went down fighting to the very end for the people. And I would like to say that the left is not marching to the left. The left is marching to the right, and the right is marching righter. Now, when we talk about privatizing Social Security and we're passing all these people off as moderates, then the definition of the word moderate has definitely changed in the United States of America. Everything is on the line. The voucherization of Medicare.
Linda, let me just stop you for a minute if I can.
The line. Go ahead.
I'm interested in knowing whether or not you think the voice of Paul Wellstone will be replaced in the Senate, or whether or not that shift that you're saying of Democrats going to the right means that perhaps that voice won't be heard in that chamber again.
Well, I believe that Senator Mondale, since he was a disciple, I mean, Wellstone was a disciple of Mondale, will temporarily replace him, and perhaps that Wellstone's death will become a symbol. I am certainly, well, I was energized before, but I do believe it may energize some young people because he is irreplaceable, but we need that sort of voice in the United States Senate. Teddy Kennedy is 69 or 70 years old. We need the voice of liberalism because we now hear the shift in the media itself. People that are, on my view, to the far right are now passed off as moderates. Roe v. Wade, which we took as a given, hangs by a single vote in the Supreme Court. If the Senate switches hands, that goes down. Environmental legislation is being gutted as we speak. If we lose the Senate, it goes down. Social Security, Medicare, the future of unions, they're attempting...
And I'm going to step in here because I'd like to actually take something that you've pointed to in terms of the your sense of the shift to the right, and go back to Sarah Binder here. I mean, Sarah, is there the Wellstone-like voice left in the Senate now?
Well, I think we should distinguish two things of Wellstone's character and his legacy, and one which the caller, Linda, is referring to. Simply put, there are very few in the Senate who you could call as passionate about his positions. There's this passion. So regardless of his ideological views, be they far left or far right or centrist or whatever, he was very clear that he stood for those views. He stuck to those. We call him principled because he was willing to cast votes that others thought were politically impossible. In his demeanor, he didn't strike you as a blow-dried politician. He was different, and I think that's part of what we say when something is lost with Paul Wellstone. One thing he wrote a book, I think, a year or two ago, and one of the things he said was, you know, I spend 80% of my time in the Senate trying to block things. Now, most senators wouldn't want to say that. They'd like to say that they are a proponent and they can point to X, Y, and Z accomplishments. And Wellstone probably had a small list of accomplishments he pointed to as well. But he was proud of the fact that he stood principally for positions. I think that's what gets lost with some of these, possibly with these new senators. When Kirk points to new senators probably being more moderate. He suggested also moderate in personality. We might think of it moderate in tone as well, that is taking a more measured approach.
Let me ask Kirk Victor about the sort of bigger sense of the Senate here, Kirk, because I'm thinking of the list that Linda took us through: environmental policy, Social Security, the control of the Supreme Court, vouchers in schools. Are all these issues going to be dramatically affected by the results of the vote on the 5th in terms of who ends up in control of the Senate?
The short answer would be no, simply because of the Senate rules and procedures. And so much of what happens in the Senate requires 60 votes because so many issues are filibustered. I do think, however, that the one overriding issue, I think Linda had a very fair point in, is on judicial nominations, whether they be Supreme Court nominations or lower court nominations. Control of the Senate, even by a single vote, can be quite significant If Republicans retake control of the Senate, Orrin Hatch will replace Patrick Leahy as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, and suddenly President Bush's nominees, including a couple that have been shot down recently, a judge in Mississippi, Pickering, Charles Pickering, and one in Texas, Priscilla Owen, probably will be resubmitted, will get through the Judiciary Committee on a party line vote, will go to the floor, and I would hazard a guess to say they'd both be confirmed. So on judicial nominations, I think it makes a huge difference. Otherwise, on a lot of these issues, I'm not as persuaded that it will because of the nature of the Senate and its procedural rules.
And Sarah, what about the larger big issue that's on the table that we haven't got to yet, Iraq and foreign policy decisions that are a part of that or separate from it in terms of control of the Senate?
Well, I think the big vote here has already been cast in terms of authorizing President Bush to take preemptive action in the Gulf. So to a large extent, the tough issue's been broached here already, and Democrats have essentially signed on to that. The more nitty-gritty question in the upcoming Congress, if and when the country does go to war in Iraq, is the question of funding for that war. And we can think of a number of scenarios that might be affected by whether Democrats or Republicans control the Senate. But none of the options are ones probably that Bush would want to sign on to, that is raising taxes or cutting too much spending. My guess is we simply see the Congress moving towards more deficit spending to fund the war. So at least in the short term, I'm not sure I see control of the Senate having that much impact on what happens with respect to the war.
Okay, 1-800-423-TALK. Linda, thanks for your call. To Dave, who's joining us from Boston. Hi, Dave.
Yes, good morning. I'm a moderate conservative living in Massachusetts, and unfortunately I don't always have the choices that I'd like to vote for. But I noticed that as Linda was talking about what was going to happen, her tone became a little hysterical toward the end of her conversation. The point remains that...
Hysterical's a little harsh, Dave, but...
But the point is that if the country chooses to go the route of turning over to the Republicans in the Senate, then this is obviously what the country wants. And the fact is that if we continue along our path, it looks like... I think the Senate will go Republican, and I will take my answer off the air.
No, just stick with me, if you would, Dave, because I'm interested. You're saying that it would serve your interest to see the Senate go Republican, so you've got that chamber in sync with the president, right?
Exactly.
Because you see too much being held up or not enough being done?
Actually, both. I think that... the Great Society is over, and some of the programs that the more liberal members of the Democratic Party would like to continue is no longer the way that the country wants to go. And if these things change, it's because the tone of the country has changed over the last 20 years since Ronald Reagan.
Let me ask Kirk for your sense, Kirk, on what difference it would make if Bush had... some kind of comfortable control of the Senate. It might be two seats or three seats, but whether or not you see that making a difference, as Dave's suggesting he thinks it might.
Well, again, I mean, the most obvious area in which it would, I go back to judicial nominations. And I should also note that as he has campaigned throughout the country, and again, particularly in the South, President Bush has repeatedly cited his frustration that the Senate has, in his words, played petty politics with his nominations to the bench. And he's been very frustrated by that. And as I say, even a pickup of a single seat could make an enormous difference there. I think other areas in which a difference, there would be a difference, is this Senate has not passed a budget resolution, which sets a framework for the budget. That will pass. I think that a Homeland Security Department will pass. That could also happen in a lame duck session after the election. So, so there will be some things, but still, I would say the most significant change, if Republicans retake control of the Senate, is that President Bush will have his way far more often when it comes to judicial nominations.
But Sarah, if the Senate does go Republican, does Bush lose a very convenient whipping boy, someone else to blame when policy decisions don't go the way that he would like them to?
Well, I think there's some possibility of that, that he's found it useful to have Democrats to blame for obstruction. One thing to keep in mind, obviously, he will have a Democratic opponent, obviously, in the 2004 race coming, so there'll be plenty of Democrats for him to attack or to blame. One thing that has been useful to him in blaming a Democratic Senate is that sometimes these difficulties in legislating have been due as much to differences amongst congressional Republicans as they have to differences with the Democratic Senate. So we can name a couple of healthcare issues, for example, patients' Bill of Rights. For the last couple of Congresses, at least the last two Congresses, we've had House and Senate producing very different patients' Bill of Rights bills. Prescription drugs, we've had somewhat of a similar problem from the perspective of healthcare advocates on the energy bill, oil drilling in the Arctic. We've had two different outcomes in the House and the Senate. So oftentimes these differences are due to Republican differences. Those Republican differences might not go away if Republicans control the Senate, and they might be even more visible, transparent in the coming Congress.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. The question this hour, the balance of power in the Senate, whether or not you see a shift to Republican control or Democratic control, is making a big difference in your life, in the direction of the country. 1-800-423-8255. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up at noon on Here and Now, reports on the probe of the assassination of a U.S. diplomat in Jordan, Russia's...
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. The death last Friday of the liberal Senator Paul Wellstone and the plane crash in Minnesota focuses the attention of the nation on the midterm elections, now just 1 week away, not just because of how close the race in Minnesota was, but as a reminder of the number of close races and the fact that the control of the Senate hangs in the balance in this election. Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. With me on the program, Kirk Victor, political reporter for the National Journal. That's a magazine about politics and government based in Washington. Sarah Binder's with us. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and associate professor of political science at George Washington University. We're going to start in Savannah, Georgia. Billy's joining us. Hi, Billy.
Hey, Dick, how are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Enjoyed your program. Well, I've got a question for Mr. Victor from the National Journal. My question really has to do with the race here in Georgia between Cleland and Saxby Chambliss. How vulnerable do the Democrats feel about that race? And more importantly, how important is the African-American turnout going to be? Does there look to be a push like there was in 2000 to get that vote out?
Go ahead, Kirk.
Thank you. It's always good to get a call from my hometown. I would say several things to Billy. One is the African American turnout in Georgia is absolutely critical in order for Senator Cleland to prevail, and he will have to get an overwhelming margin in that African American community, which I think he will do. The question will be the extent to which how successful the Democrats are in getting out that critical vote. I think Billy's other question, the Democrats are nervous, although I don't think they are saying that publicly so much, but the race, the margin, according to polls, has narrowed somewhat in the last week or two. The problem, I think, with some of those polls, and this goes for many of the Deep South states, is that often they are not as good at picking up the African-American turnout. Who can predict? There's so many extraneous factors, whether it be weather or other factors that are just very difficult to predict. So sometimes the polls in the Deep South are not right. But right now there is nervousness among Democrats, though they're not publicly saying it.
Billy, let me get your sense of the campaign that you're watching in Savannah. Are you seeing a personality campaign between Cleland and Chambliss? Is it a party campaign? How are you reading it?
Well, it's been an interesting campaign in the sense that every candidate around here seems to want to grab onto the coattails of George Bush, Cleland included. But the interesting thing, I think what Kirk said about the turnout is that I don't think in the rural counties of Georgia that turned out in the 2000 election pretty heavily for Gore. Of course, Bush won Georgia handily, but there were a lot of rural counties that went that are heavily African-American, and they went to Gore, and I don't think that was really expected. But I think there was a real concerted effort to get it out. But I think polls, as you point out, polls that are done by the Journal Constitution and papers like that, they don't really have a full grasp on what's going to actually happen on Election Day.
Billy, thanks for your call.
Yeah, tell Kirk, sorry about the Giants.
You just
thanks,
told
Billy.
Him yourself.
I appreciate it.
1-800-423-TALK. And let's go to Appleton, Wisconsin. Nate's on the line. Hello, Nate.
Yeah, good morning, guys. I just wanted to make a quick follow-up point to one of your previous customers or callers who said that, you know, if the country was trending conservative or Republican, it was because, you know, people were voting that way. You know, without rehashing the entire 2002 election, I think it's worth pointing out that George Bush spent three times more money than anyone in the history of presidential politics. He was running against what I think a lot of people would say was a lame candidate. And the majority of Americans rejected George Bush's agenda. So we have a plebiscite of the American people that says we don't want what the Republicans are selling. And now it comes out that a majority of the people in Florida voted against George Bush. And, you know, when you look at the people who are running the Republican Party in Congress, you've got Trent Lott, you've got Dick Armey, you've got Tom DeLay. These are extremely conservative elements that are to the right within the Republican Party. And as your guest political scientist pointed out, these guys are pushing agendas that are extreme within the context of the Republican Party, and that's within a party that was rejected by the majority of Americans.
I want to just pick up the point that you've raised, Nate, and that's Florida, to ask Kirk and Sarah, both of you, whether or not all the uncertainty and all the ill will that still you can hear in people's descriptions of that time 2 years ago is going to be a factor in the midterm election.
My sense is, granted, I've not spent much time in Florida since that election, my sense is the country wants to move on, not to make too broad a generalization here. I think some issues that came from that election about voter registration and other sorts of election reform issues, those are still alive, and Congress has worked to try to address some of those. So I don't want to say that everyone has moved on from that. But I think the country is willing to take these new elections and take them as fresh starts. Obviously, what hasn't changed, as I referred to before, is this narrow 50-50 split that we saw behind that election outcome.
Right.
Those tight races, those are still with us. That's going to be probably a fact of the South as well as a fact of other regions, some of the regions for a while to come here. Just to respond to Nate's response to the earlier caller, I I think it's fair to say, as that earlier caller had said, that the Great Society days seem to be over. We simply don't have these large large Democratic majorities easily passing major policy change on a host of economic and social issues that you had in the 1960s. That's certainly the country's mood, policy mood, or public or ideological mood has moved on from that. Has it moved as far to the right as that earlier caller suggested? On this score, I guess I'm more in lines with Nate here, simply because of this 50-50 split. Mm-hmm. I don't think we've seen quite as far a march to the right nationally as we, at least we see in some legislators on the Hill.
Kirk, you've been on the road. Are there people who are still fighting 2000?
Well, I do think we do have one race where it definitely is being fought, and that's the gubernatorial race in Florida, where President Bush's brother, Jeb, is in a race for his political life. I think Bill McBride, a Vietnam veteran, has taken him on. And most polls show, although Bush is ahead, it's very, very close. And if there is any place where there is lingering bitterness, I think it is the activist Democrats in Florida. And getting back to the get out the vote issue, I have a hunch they're going to make a very, very tenacious effort, the Democrats, to get out the vote in the minority communities where there is still anger and resentment at what they feel was an election that was swiped. Now, I agree with Sarah. I don't think that's widespread at all. I think the country does want to move on, but Florida is a special case.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to a highway near Boston. Waldo's on the line. Hi, Waldo.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'm a physician. I'm a gynecologist. And I am petrified about the Senate and the ideological judges of the Republican Party. It will do away with a woman's whole life, really, which was so difficult to obtain and is now very tenuous at the moment. And I am petrified that this can happen.
So when Sarah and Kirk are talking about the crucial committee control of the Judicial Committee in the Senate, that's what you're focused on in this election?
Yeah, I'm almost a one-issued voter. I mean, I dealt in women's health issues for so long, including abortion, and I'm old enough to remember the horrible days of illegal abortion where I trained in New York. And Roe v. Wade is at risk if one vote changes in the Supreme Court. And that's, I'm petrified about it. Really.
And Sarah, how far are we away from the next nominee for the Supreme Court? Is that going to happen during the next 2 years?
Well, that's the great guessing game for everybody in D.C., and I wish I knew, but I don't. But Kirk's argument earlier that if party control of the Senate changes, the most concrete consequence certainly will be in judicial nominations. I brought with me some of my favorite numbers here. The current Congress appellate court nominees, Bush was able to get confirmed under half of them, although he did succeed in confirming over two-thirds of his district court nominees. If we reach back to the last time we had unified control of president with a congressional majority, that was under Clinton in 93-94, and upwards of 85-90% of nominees at both levels were confirmed. So party control does make a difference here. It's not without question that Democrats, if they were in the minority, could go to the floor and try to filibuster these nominees, but at this lower court level, my sense is Democrats aren't going to be willing to pay the political cost and the resources of filibustering, except on a handful, a small handful of high-profile nominees where they have these ideological concerns about the nominee. But that's, I think, going to be the exception. There'll be big cases, but I think that's the exception. I think Bush, with a Republican Senate, would have a much smoother ride for his nominees.
It's interesting, Kirk, listening to Sarah go through that list, because, of course, the concentration is always on the Supreme Court, but it is the lower courts, the appellate and the district court, that can have just as powerful effect on the direction of the judicial system that's so worrying Waldo.
No question about it. I actually have joked with colleagues that a Supreme Court position is one of the easiest gigs around now. They don't take on that many cases at all, that is, consider them. And so that is quite empowering, if you will, to the appellate courts and even the trial courts, the district courts. So I absolutely you are correct, Dick, that those lower courts take on, particularly the appellate courts, much greater significance.
Sarah, if we are to take the prevailing thesis that regardless of how these really close races pan out next week, that we're in effect going to have a 50-50 split in the Senate. In your view, does that mean that policy doesn't really move that far, particularly given the fact that a few short months after this election, we're into the start of another presidential campaign?
Well, I think we should sort of step back and think, as you suggested, about the broader political and electoral context that you inherit going into the last 2 years here of President Bush's term.
Right.
Traditionally, we say that when presidents can get things done, it's in their first or second years when they have the most political capital, the most political will, a honeymoon period of sorts. Now, granted, so that period will be over, makes it tougher for Bush, if he has a large domestic agenda, to get that through. Granted, he has quite high approval ratings. That's going to give him a little more political capital than normal. I don't expect big policy change here, although both sides would like something to show in the 2004 election. But again, it does take large bipartisan majorities to overcome the 60-vote threshold in the Senate, and that we don't see happening. Although that, granted, that said, there is something that 51 vote majorities can do in the Senate through the use of the rules known through reconciliation, a budget procedure. We saw that with the tax cut bill earlier in 2001. So there are things that can be done. We've seen precedent for it with the large education bill. But even on that, it was because we had liberal Democrats like Kennedy agreeing to compromise with the Republicans and Republicans giving up on vouchers. So it is possible to get things done, but I don't see a groundswell of legislation passing here in the upcoming 2 years.
And Kirk, less inclination to compromise in the last 2 years.
I think that's right. The two parties will want to highlight their differences, although, I agree with Sarah that they also want to take home to voters certain accomplishments. So there's a dual track, both of wanting to get some things done on a bipartisan basis while also highlighting differences that they can then go out on the road and campaign on in 2004.
Kirk, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Kirk Victor, political reporter with the National Journal. Sarah Binder, thank you for your time as well.
Thanks.
Sarah's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and associate professor of political science at George Washington University. Earlier in the program, we chatted with Bill Salisbury, reporter and columnist with the St. Paul Pioneer Press. Connection listeners, feel free to continue the conversation. You can find our forum pages at our website. We're at theconnection.org. Our program's produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Arete Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Graham Smith's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is WB.